Harper Audio presents I Am Number 4, The Lost Files, Secret Histories, by Pittacus Lore, performed by Kaleo Griffith and John Reynolds. The Search for Sam. Chapter 1.
I don't know if I can. I'm too weak to speak, so I don't say it out loud. I merely think it. But one can hear me. She can always hear me. "You have to," she says. "You have to wake up. You have to fight." I'm at the bottom of a ravine, my legs twisted beneath me. A boulder pushed uncomfortably between my shoulder blades. A stream laps against my thigh. I can't see anything, because my eyes are closed, and I can't open my eyes, because I don't have the strength. But, to be honest, I don't want to open my eyes. I want to give up, to let go. Opening my eyes means facing the truth. It means realizing that I have been washed onto a dry riverbank. That the wet I feel in my legs is no river. It's blood. From a compound fracture of my right leg, the bone now jutting out of my shin. It means knowing that I've been left for dead by my own father, some 7,000 miles from home. That the closest thing I have to a brother, Ivanik, is the one who nearly killed me, pushing me brutally off the edge of the steep ravine. It means facing the fact that I am a Mogadorian, a member of an alien race bent on the extermination of the Lorik people and the eventual domination of Earth. I clench my eyes shut, desperately trying to hide from the truth. With my eyes still closed, I can drift off to a sweeter place, a California beach, my bare feet digging into the sand. One sits beside me, looking at me with a smile. This is one's memory of California, a place I've never been. But we've shared the memory for so long during that 3-year twilight that it feels as much mine as hers. "I could stay here all day," I say, the sun warm on my skin. She looks at me with a soft smile, like she couldn't agree more. But when she opens her mouth to speak, her words don't match her expression. They're harsh, stern, commanding. "You can't stay," she says. "You have to get up. Now!" My eyes open. I'm in my bed in the volunteers' sleeping quarters at the aid camp. One stands at the end of the bed. As in my dream, she's smiling. But now it isn't a sweet smile. It's a teasing smirk. "God," she says, rolling her eyes, "you sleep a lot." I laugh. Sitting up in bed, I do sleep a lot lately. It's been 7 weeks since I pulled myself out of the ravine, and other than some residual weakness in my right leg, I've made a full recovery. But my sleep schedule hasn't adjusted. I'm still sleeping 10 hours a night. I look around the hut and see that all the other beds are empty. My fellow aid workers have already risen for morning chores. I get to my feet, wobbling briefly on my right leg. One smirks again at my clumsiness. Ignoring her, I slip into my sandals, throw on a shirt, and exit the hut. Outside, the sun and humidity hit me like a wall. I'm still sticky from sleep, and I'd kill for a shower. But Marco and the other workers are already elbow deep in morning chores. I missed my chance. The first hour of the day is devoted to housekeeping around camp. Cooking breakfast, doing laundry, cleaning dishes. After that, a jeep will pick some of us up and take us deeper into the village. We're currently working on a water project there, modernizing the town's antiquated well. The others will stay behind in the classroom next to camp, teaching the village children. I've been trying to learn Swahili, but I've got a ways to go before I'll be ready to teach. I bust my ass at the camp. It gives me great pleasure to help the villagers. But mostly, I work as hard as I do out of gratitude. After dragging my busted body out of the ravine and a quarter mile through the jungle, I was eventually discovered by an elderly villager. She mistook me for an aid worker, my cover while tracking down Hanu, number 3. She went to the camp and returned an hour later with Marco and a visiting doctor. I was brought back to camp on a makeshift stretcher. The doctor reset my leg, stitched it up, and put me in a cast I've only recently shed. Marco gave me a place here, first to recover, and now to volunteer, without asking any questions. All he expects in return is that I do my chores and that I fulfill the same labor requirements as the other aid workers. I have no idea what story he's constructed in his head to account for my condition. I can only figure that Marco must have guessed correctly that Ivan was the one who did this to me, based on the fact that Ivan disappeared on the day of my accident without a word to anybody at camp. Perhaps Marco's generosity is motivated by pity. He may not know exactly what happened, but he knows I was forsaken by family. And since Marco is more or less right, I don't mind him pitying me. Besides, the funny thing about being forsaken by my family, by my entire race, I've never been happier. Renovating the village's well is sweaty, tedious work, but I have an advantage the other workers don't. I have one. I talk to her throughout my work, and though my muscles get sore and my back aches, the hours fly. Mostly, she motivates me by teasing me. You're doing that wrong. You call that troweling? If I had a body, I'd be done with that by now. She mocks my efforts, reclining like a sunbathing lady of leisure at the edge of the worksite. You want to try this? I bark back in my mind. Couldn't, she'll say. Don't want to break a nail. Of course, I have to be careful not to actually speak to her while I work, not in front of the others. I developed a reputation as a bit of a weirdo for talking to myself in my first few weeks here. Then I'd learned to silence my side of the conversation with one, to merely think at her, instead of actually speaking. Thankfully, my reputation has recovered, and the others no longer look at me like I might be a total lunatic. That night I have kitchen duty with Elswit, the camp's most recent addition. We cook githeri, a simple dish of corn and beans. Elswit shucks and scrapes the cobs of corn, while I soak and rinse the beans. I like Elswit. He asks a lot of questions about where I come from and what brought me here. Questions I know better than to answer with the truth. Fortunately, he doesn't seem to mind that my replies are either vague or non-existent. He's a big talker, always racing ahead to the next question without noticing my silence, always interjecting tidbits about his own life and upbringing instead. From what I've gathered, he's the son of a very wealthy American banker, a man who does not approve of Elswit's humanitarian pursuits. Living up to my father's standards was difficult enough when I was a child, but after my experiences in one's mind, it became impossible. I had grown soft, had developed sympathies and concerns that I knew would be impossible for my father to understand, let alone tolerate. Elswit and I have a certain amount in common. We're both disappointments to our fathers. But I quickly realized the similarities between us don't stretch that far. Despite Elswit's claims of estrangement from his family, he's still in touch with his wealthy parents and still has unlimited access to their wealth. Apparently, his father has even arranged for a private plane to pick him up in Nairobi in a few weeks just so Elswit can be back home for his birthday. Meanwhile, my dad thinks I'm dead, and I can only guess he's happy about it. After dinner, I have a well-earned shower and get into bed. One's curled up in a rattan chair in the corner. Bed? Already? She teases. I give the room a once-over. No one's around, so it's safe to talk out loud, as long as I keep my voice down. Talking out loud feels more natural than communicating silently. I want to get up with the others from here on out. One shoots me a look. What? My cast's off. My limp's almost gone. I'm recovered. It's time for me to pull equal weight around here. One frowns and picks at her shirt. Of course, I know what's bothering her. Her people are out there, earmarked for extinction by my race. And here she is, stuck in Kenya. Moreover, she's stuck inside my consciousness, disembodied, with no will or agency of her own. If she had her wish, I know she'd be somewhere else, anywhere else, taking up the fight. How long are we going to stay here? She asks, somberly. I play dumb, pretending I don't know how she feels, and shrug as I pull up the covers and turn over on my side. I don't have anywhere else to be. I'm dreaming. It's the night I tried to save Hanu. I'm running from the aid camp into the jungle, towards Hanu's hut, desperate to get there before Ivan and my father do. I know how this ends. Hanu killed, me left for dead. But in this dream, all of the naive urgency of that night comes back to me, propelling me forward through the vines and brush, the shadows, the animal sounds. The communicator I swiped from the hut crackles at my hip, an ominous sound. I know the other Mogadorians are closing in. I have to get there first. I have to. I arrive at a clearing in the jungle. The hut where Hanu and his sepan lived stands right where I remembered it. My eyes struggle to adjust to the darkness. Then I see the difference. The hut and the clearing itself are completely overgrown with vines and foliage. Half of the hut's facade has been blown out, and the roof sags heavily over the missing section of wall. The obstacle course at the edge of the grounds that Hanu must have used for training is so overgrown, I can barely tell what it is anymore. "I'm sorry," comes a voice from the jungle. I whip around. "Who's there?" One emerges from the trees. "You're sorry for what?" I'm confused, out of breath, and my feet hurt from running. That's when it clicks. "I'm not dreaming," I say. One shakes her head. "Nope." "You took over." The words escape my lips before I even understand what I'm saying. But I can tell from her face I'm right. She took over my consciousness while I slept, leading me out here to the site of Hanu's death. She's never done this before. I had no idea she even could do this. But her being is so intimately enmeshed with my own at this point, I shouldn't be surprised. "You hijacked me." "I'm sorry, Adam," she says, "but I needed you to come here, to remind you." "Well, it didn't work." I'm confused, angered by one's manipulation of my will. But as soon as I say it, I know it's a lie. It did work. My adrenaline's up, my heart is racing, and I feel it. The crushing importance of what I tried and failed to do months ago. The threat my people still pose to the guard and to the rest of the world. They must be stopped. I turn away, so one can't see the doubt on my face. But we share a mind. There's no hiding from her. "I know you feel it too," she says. She's right, but I push it away, that nagging sense that I have a calling I'm ignoring out here in Kenya. Things were just starting to get good again. I like my life in Kenya. I like that I'm making a difference, and until one dragged me out here to rub my nose in the sight of Hanu's murder, it had gotten easy for me to forget about the coming war. I shake my head. "I'm doing good work, Juan. I'm helping people." "Yeah," she says. "What about doing great? You could be helping the guard to save the planet. Besides, do you really think the Mogadorians will spare this place when their ultimate plan takes form? Don't you realize that any work you do in the village is just building on quicksand unless you join the fight to stop your people?" Sensing that she's getting through to me, she steps closer. "Adam, you could be so much more." "I'm not a hero," I cry, my voice catching in my throat. "I'm a weakling, a defector." "Adam," she begs, her voice catching now too. "You know I like to tease you, and I'd really hate for you to get a big head or something. But you are one in a million, one in 10 million. You are the only Mogadorian who has ever defied Mogadorian authority. You have no idea how special you are, how useful to the cause you could be. All I've ever wanted is for one to see me as special, as a hero. I wish I could believe her now, but I know she's wrong. No, the only thing that's special about me is you. If Dr. Anu hadn't hooked me up to your brain, if I hadn't spent 3 years living inside your memories, I'd have been the one who killed Hanu, and I'd probably have been proud of it. I see one flinch. Good, I think. I'm getting through to her. You were a member of the guard. You had powers, I say. I'm just a skinny, powerless ex-Mogadorian. The best I can do is survive. I'm sorry. I turn around and begin my long walk back to camp. One doesn't follow. Chapter 2. Despite my exhausting middle-of-the-night run to Hanu's hut, I managed to wake up with the other aid workers the following morning. "Look at you, getting up early," jokes Elswit. "Sure you want to cut into your beauty sleep?" I almost retaliate by teasing Elswit, calling him the prince like the other workers sometimes do. He earned the nickname when he arrived here with a bunch of expensive non-essentials, none more ridiculous than a luxurious pair of shiny silk pajamas. Nobody makes fun of him to his face, though. He also brought a top-of-the-line laptop with high-tech global wireless, a device he lets us all use and that no one wants to jeopardize their access to. As I get dressed, I notice that one is nowhere to be seen. She's usually up before I am, hanging around. I figure she's sulking from our fight in the jungle. That, or she's just disappeared for a while. She does that sometimes. Once I asked her about it, "Where do you go when you're not here?" She gave me a cryptic look. "Nowhere," was all she said. We step outside to begin our chores, only to find a light rain is starting. It's good for the village, but it means the water project will be suspended for the day. The soil is too difficult to work with when it's raining. So, after our chores, me, Marco, and Elswit are free to loaf around and to read or write letters. I ask Elswit if I can have an hour with his computer. He's quick to say yes. Elswit might be a spoiled prince, but he's a generous one. I take the laptop to the hut and begin poking around on news sites. When I get time with Elswit's laptop, I always research possible Loric or Mogadorian activities. I may have removed myself from the battle, but I'm still curious about the fate of the guard. It's a slow news day. I double-check to make sure that I'm alone, then open up a program I've created and installed on Elswit's laptop. I've hacked into the wireless signals from Ashwood Estates, my former home, and created a shadow directory that caches Ashwood IM and email chatter. I wish I could claim I was motivated by some heroic agenda, but the truth is, my motive is so pathetic, I'd rather die than discuss it with one. I just want to find out if my family misses me. My family. They think I'm dead. The truth is, they're probably happy about it. I spent most of my life on Earth in a gated community in Virginia called Ashwood Estates, where true-born Mogadorians live in normal suburban houses, wearing normal American clothes, living under normal American names, hiding in plain sight. But below the granite countertops and walk-in closets and faux marble flooring, unseen by the mortals of Earth, spreads a massive network of laboratories and training facilities where trueborns and vat-born Mogs work and plot together to bring about the destruction and subjugation of the entire universe. As the son of the legendary Mogadorian warrior Andrakas Sutek, I was expected to be a faithful soldier in this shadowy war. I was enlisted as a subject in an experiment to extract the memories of the first fallen Loric, the girl known as One. The plan was to use the information from those memories against her people, to help us track and exterminate the rest of her kind. The mind transfer experiment worked only too well. I spent 3 years in a coma, locked inside the memories of the dead Loric, living through her happiest and most painful moments, as if they were my own. Eventually, I woke from the coma, but I came back to my Mogadorian life different, with an abiding distaste for bloodshed, a queasy but consuming sympathy for the hunted Lorik, and with the ghost of one as my constant companion. In the first of my betrayals, I lied to my people, claiming the experiment had failed, and that I had no memory of my encounter with one's consciousness. I tried to change back to be a normal bloodthirsty Mogadorian, but with one always around me, whether as a voice in my head or a vision at my side, it became impossible to assist my people in their attacks on the Lorik. As if led by some inexorable force, I became a traitor, working against my people's efforts. I attempted to save the third Lorik marked for death. This Lorik died anyway, gleefully murdered by my father right before my eyes. Despite my pathetic efforts, I failed to save him. Exposed as a traitor, I was thrown from a ravine by Ivanik and left for dead. In all of my electronic snooping, I haven't been able to pinpoint any communication from my family. Maybe that's a good thing. Something tells me that it would probably just hurt my feelings. Obviously, all official communication from the underground Mogadorian facilities are firewalled well beyond my ability to hack. But the Ashwood Estate signals weren't too difficult to break into. One chink in the Mogadorian armor is their expectation of total obedience. But as a former suburban Mog kid, I know that Mogadorian teenagers often flout their parents' rules and use the above-ground wireless to talk about things they're not technically supposed to. Not that they're that loose-lipped. The cache I've created is mostly filled with tedious emails and chats that have nothing to do with Mogadorian secrets. But the last time I logged on, I did manage to decrypt the IM chatter of a particularly big-mouthed true-born Mog, Arsis. Apparently, this Arsis kid was demoted from combat training to a job working as an assistant technician in the labs. Arsis is so eager for information about combat ops that all he does is whine and blab to some friend from his former unit about everything he sees and does in the lab, all in the hopes that his friend will reciprocate. So far, his friend has been mum, but I've managed to learn a good deal about what's going on below Ashwood. Arsis, it's so boring. Another whole day, guarding the door to Dr. Zakos' lab. Apparently, they've got humans in there plugged into machines. I don't know if they are being tortured or what, 'cause I'm not even allowed inside. Whatever sympathy I feel for Arsis is obliterated by his atrocious spelling and grammar. It's worse than Ivan's. I didn't think such a thing was even possible. Farther down in the transcript, I discover another detail. Arsis. There's only one left, and I guess he's not even awake, just plugged into machines that dredge their brains for info. Dr. Zakos thinks tech will improve in the next few years, and they will get decent intel from their brains. Whatever. It's been a whole week, and all I get to do is clean the lab equipment. I've never even heard of Dr. Zakos. I wonder if he is Dr. Anu's successor. I wonder if there's some connection between this dredging they are doing to the captive humans and the technology they use to hook me into one's memories. I wonder... What you doing? Startled, I realize that one has curled up beside me on the bed, a Cheshire grin on her face. As nonchalantly as I can manage, I click out of my program and close the laptop. Her grin curls into a frown. Keeping secrets now, are we? We share a brain, I say. It's not like I can hide anything from you, even if I want to. She's quiet for a moment, no doubt processing everything I've just learned from my snooping. Answer me this, she says. I put my hands up. Shoot. If you're so determined not to get involved, why bother digging around at all? It's a good question, but I brush it off. Just because I'm curious doesn't mean I can do anything. I pick up the laptop and get off the bed. I have to get this back to Elswit. I pause in the doorway. One has a pensive, inscrutable look on her face. The only thing I can read is her continued disappointment in me. "Sorry, One," I say, turning to go. My answer's still no.
Chapter 3.
The rain finally stops in the middle of the night, so the following morning after chores, Marco, Elswit, and I head back into the village on the jeep and resume our work on the well. It's muddy, which slows us down and complicates our work. As a result, I'm so involved in my job, I don't even notice One's absence until I'm halfway done with the day. I don't have her usual chatter to help pass the rest of the time, but I'm kind of relieved she's not around. I'm still haunted by the disappointed look on her face yesterday, and I could use a little time off from her judgment. After work, me and Elswit make a yam mash for dinner, and then join a few of the other workers for a game of cards in the recreation tent. Around 10, I return to the hut. Marco's already under the covers, asleep. I undress quietly and slip into my bed, conscious of One's continued absence. It's unlike her to disappear for so long. I scan the room, looking to see if she's tucked into some corner, hiding, but she's nowhere to be seen. "One?" I whisper, as quietly as I can. "You there?" No answer. "Come on, One." A little louder this time.
"Dude!"
It's Marco.
"I'm trying to sleep!"
Hearing Marco say, "Dude," with his funny Italian accent, is usually a highlight of my time at the camp. But getting caught talking to my invisible friend, I'm mortified. "Sorry, man," I say, blushing, annoyed with One for making me raise my voice. I still expect to see her emerge from a doorway or closet any minute, laughing at me for getting busted talking to myself. But she's nowhere to be seen. I try to sleep, tossing and turning as the room fills up with the other aid workers, one by one. But sleep doesn't come. For all of One's comings and goings, I've never gone a whole day without seeing her. Not since those 3 years I spent plugged into her memories. She's just always been there. Eventually, I give up trying to sleep. I half-dress, put on my sandals, and shuffle out to the compound's backyard. It's surprisingly cold, and I clutch my arms to my chest for warmth. It's dark outside, barely illuminated by moonlight and the dim lamp next to the latrine, and it takes me a minute for my eyes to adjust. That's when I see her, a faint outline crouched beside the baobab tree at the center of the yard. I approach slowly. "One?" She looks up at me. I can't tell if it's a trick of the moonlight, but there's something strange about the way she looks. It's like she's both luminescent and too dark to see. She remains silent. I stop in my tracks. "Come on, this isn't funny." "Oh," she says, laughing bitterly. "I agree. This isn't funny at all." I can tell from her voice that she's been crying. "I didn't want you to see me like this," she says. Now I'm spooked. "See you like what?" But up close, I understand what she means. Her skin, her whole being, is strangely milky, almost translucent. I can look right through her. "I keep disappearing," she says. "Lately, it's been taking all my strength to keep myself visible." I'm quiet, afraid to speak. But I'm also afraid to listen, afraid of what she'll say next. She turns to me, staring right into my eyes. "Remember when I told you I went nowhere, when I was gone from you?" "Yeah," I say. "I thought you were just being mysterious." She shakes her head, tears welling in her eyes. "I was being literal, actually. I really do go nowhere. I disappear completely." Now she's crying freely. Each time I can feel myself getting weaker, less real. It keeps happening. I can still fight it, but it's getting harder. It feels like I'm dying all over again. She closes her eyes. As she does, she flickers in and out of visibility. I can intermittently see the bark of the tree behind her. Well, she says, opening her eyes again, Dr. Anu never promised this would last. One, I begin. What are you saying? I ask the question even though a part of me, the one part of me, already knows the answer. My existence, us, this. She gestures to the empty space between us. You're forgetting me, Adam. That's impossible, one. I'll never forget you. She smiles sadly. I know you'll always remember me. That's not what I'm talking about. It's one thing to remember I existed. It's another for me to stay alive inside of you. I shake my head and turn away, not following, not willing to listen. It's been a while since we were connected in Anu's lab. Too long, I guess. I'm fading. The way we are, the way we talk to each other, the way you can see me, the way I feel alive, even though I died years ago. Maybe forgetting is the wrong way of putting it, but whatever you want to call it, this wasn't built to last. It's breaking down. Seeing how upset I'm getting, she shrugs, trying to seem casual. We're both going to have to accept it. My time is running out. No, I say, refusing to believe it. But when I turn back to her, she's already gone. After a restless night, searching for one and eventually making my way back to the cabin alone, I drag myself out of bed. I brush my teeth, get dressed, finish my morning chores. I work in the village under the baking sun. What choice do I have? It's not like I can ask Marco for time off. Hey, Marco, a few months ago I emerged from a 3-year coma during which I lived inside the memories of a dead alien girl, and she's been my constant companion ever since. But now she's dying, this time for good. Any chance you could cover me at the well today? Wouldn't really fly. So I grit my teeth and keep working. One is not as scarce today as she was yesterday. I saw her briefly when I woke up, but she stayed far away, and she's hanging out at the edge of camp when I returned from the village, sitting against the same tree as last night. Don't, she says, as I walk over to join her. No puppy dog eyes, please. One, I start. I'm fine, she says, interrupting me. Yesterday was just a bad day. I'm sure I've got a few more weeks. I'm speechless. Heartbroken. You've got dinner to cook. I balk. Dinner? Who cares about dinner when I have so little time left with her? You have to leave. Oswald's giving you funny looks for talking to a tree. She laughs, waving me off. Go! I head to the kitchen. As we cook, Oswald tells me stories about his rich kid misadventures, before he got his shit together and dedicated himself to service. Usually I find Ellsworth's stories amusing, but my mind keeps drifting back to one, sitting under the tree. This camp, the village, these have been my sanctuary the past couple months, and it has gotten so easy to imagine a happy future for myself here. But when I look across camp to see one, flickering in and out of sight, leaning wearily against the tree, I imagine what this place feels like to her. While her people are out there fighting for survival, she's stuck here for her last hours simply because I found a place where I feel safe. I realize that to her, this place isn't a home. It's a grave. Chapter 4. I lean back in my airplane seat, staring at the passport in my hand as the jet hums somewhere over the Atlantic. Adam Sutton. In the photo, I'm beaming. the tooth I lost in battle with Ivan, a small black gap in my smile. Looking at Adam Sutton's smiling face, no one would ever know how afraid I am, what an insane risk I'm taking right now. Elswit sits next to me, headphones on, watching some first-run blockbuster on his tablet computer while joggling his knees. The joggling is annoying, but I'm in no position to complain. Elswit came through for me big time. I didn't even have to come up with a grand lie for him. I just told him I had a family crisis and needed to get back to the United States. He said that was all he needed to know. He took me to the American Embassy in Nairobi, paid for my new passport, and arranged for me to join him on his father's private jet, already scheduled to bring him home to Northern California for his birthday. If I didn't already have an active American identity, none of this would have worked. Fortunately, my father, Andrew Sutton, never bothered to report me missing. I wonder what alarms my passport replacement might have set off at the Mogadorian headquarters, but I guess it doesn't make any difference. When I show up at Ashwood Estates, either they'll kill me or they won't. Knowing I'm coming shouldn't make a difference. We touch down in London to refuel, our second refueling stop. Now we're back in the air, next stop, Virginia, where I'll part ways with Elswit. At that point, nothing besides a cab ride to Ashwood will stand between me and my upcoming confrontation with my family. I sink deeper into my seat, dreading my arrival. Must be scary. I turn to see one, sitting in the seat next to mine. She's been gone for most of the 20-hour trip, off to her own private purgatory. I can't even imagine. Yeah, I say. I don't need to say any more. One knows what I'm thinking. I'm about to see my family again for the first time in months. I expect to be greeted as a traitor. Maybe I'll be executed for treason, killed where I stand, or fed to a piken. Mogadorians have no particular history or protocol for handling treason. Dissent is not a problem they have much, if any, experience with. I know my only hope is to convince the general that I'm worth more to him alive than dead. You don't have to do this, she says, a guilty, worried expression on her face. It's dangerous. When I talked about taking up the cause, I didn't mean this. This is what we have to do, I say. I sound way more certain than I feel. But I have no choice. I can't lose her. Once we land, we don't need to go to Ashwood. We can go anywhere. Try to find the other Lorik. Screw the others, I say. Though my plan is vague, I know that my hope of saving one, of keeping her by my side, lies somewhere in the laboratory beneath Ashwood Estates. I'm not doing this for them. I know, she says. You're doing this to try and save me, to find some way to keep me alive. You think if you go back, you can maybe find some way into the labs, and maybe my body's still there. Maybe you can re-engage the mind transfer, restore me, buy me a few more years. She bites her lip, worried about the risk I'm taking. Seems like a lot of maybes to risk your life over. She's right. But I don't have a choice. Without one, I'm nothing. Even a 1% chance of succeeding is worth pursuing. In the cab on the way to Ashwood Estates, my fear is like a fist in my stomach, pushing upwards. We're getting close. Maybe 10 minutes away. 9 minutes. 8 minutes. I feel bile churning. I ask the driver to pull over to the side of the road, and I rush out to the tall grass at the edge of the highway and throw up what little I've eaten since leaving Kenya. I take a moment to breathe, to look out over the grass to the open fields beyond. I know this is it, my last chance to run. Then I wipe my mouth and return to the cab, grateful that one isn't around to see me like this.
You okay, kid?
The driver asks. I nod. Yeah. The driver just shakes his head and gets us back on the road. 6 minutes. 5 minutes. We entered the suburbs surrounding Ashwood Estates. Fast food glutted intersections give way to middle-class townships, then to upscale gated communities indistinguishable from Ashwood. The perfect hiding place. From above, we're just another suburb. No one would imagine the strange culture inside those tastefully bland McMansions, the world-destroying plans being hatched below. In all my years living at Ashwood, we've never fallen under a moment's suspicion from the government or the local police. As Ashwood's imposing gates loom into view up the road, I find myself darkly amused by the irony that a walled fortress has been such an effective way to deflect suspicion in suburban America. I tell the driver to let me off across the street, passing him the last of the money that Elswit was kind enough to give me to get home. I approach the front gate's intercom system, glad I threw up back on the highway. If I hadn't then, I would now. There's no point being coy. I step right in front of the security camera and press the buzzer for my house and look right into the camera. Every house has a direct feed to it. I will be identified immediately.
Adamus?
It's my mother. Her voice cracks on the second syllable, and at the sound of it, my legs almost give out. I know she's a monster. She wants nothing more than the destruction of the entire Loric race and domination of this entire planet. But the sound of her voice hits me hard. I've missed her, more than I realized.
Mom?
I say, struggling to keep my voice from breaking. But the intercom line has gone dead. She's probably pulled an alarm, notified the general. Within minutes, I'll be on a rack, or thrown into a Pikin's feeding pen.
Adamus?
Her voice again. It's not coming from the intercom. I step around the intercom panel to see my mother in the distance through the gate. She's run out of our house at the top of the hill. She's in a sundress, the kind she wears when she's baking, running down the hill, barefoot, running towards me. In rage? In confusion? I steel myself for her approach.
Adam!
She cries, getting closer and closer, her bare feet slapping against the asphalt. Before I know it, she swung open the pedestrian access gate and has pulled me into her arms, hugging me, crying.
My sweet boy, my fallen hero, you're alive.
I'm stunned. She's not greeting me with anger. She's greeting me with love.
Chapter 5. I sit on our living room couch, sipping the lemonade my mother brought me. She's talking up a storm, and I'm careful not to interrupt. I need to tread carefully to figure out what happened here before I commit to a particular story.
I didn't believe them,
she says, sitting next to me and putting a hand on my knee.
I couldn't believe them.
I take another sip, buying myself some time.
Didn't believe them about what?
They told me everything, and I knew it had happened, but I didn't believe it. I knew you couldn't really be dead.
Oh, she couldn't believe that part.
I've always known physical combat wasn't your gift. I told your father 1,000 times you'd be better suited to a tactical role, but he was determined not to break with custom, and insisted we make no distinction between combat and strategy. Everyone must fight in the war. But when he told me you'd been killed, that disgusting Loric had thrown you off a cliff, it felt like my worst fears had come true.
My mind reels. It was my adopted brother, Ivan, who threw me into the ravine, under my father's approving gaze. I hadn't been killed by a Loric. I'd joined the Loric cause.
They said they searched high and low for you.
A lie. They left me for dead.
That they were as heartbroken as I was.
More lies.
But they didn't find your body, and that gave me some hope. I knew in my heart that somehow you had managed to survive.
She hugs me again. It takes all of my effort to receive her hug without betraying the revolution going on inside me.
I expected to return home to a Mogadorian firing squad, but instead, I've come back as a fallen soldier.
No.
His voice. My mother and I turn at once to see my father in the doorway, his mouth open in shock. He's come back to us, my mother exclaims. Our boy's alive! I have never in my entire life seen the general at a loss for words. But there he is, too stunned to speak. In a flash, I understand everything. My father lied to my mother. My father lied to the rest of the Mogadorians, whether to protect his ego from disgrace or to maintain his authority as a general, or both. He fabricated an honorable death for me. No one here except my father, and Ivan, wherever he is, knows that I turned against the Mogadorian cause. I only have a moment to act, to interpret my father's stunned silence and play it to my advantage. I leap off the couch and embrace him. I'm alive, father! I feel all 6.5 feet of his body stiffen in disgust. But I forge ahead with my ruse. I've come home! I tell them a story of my return to Ashwood, washing up on the shore at the bottom of the ravine, being rescued by a local, recovering at the aid camp. I adjust the truth slightly, characterizing my human friends as fools, claiming that I deliberately manipulated Elswit for his assistance in order to get back here, painting myself as the Mogadorian loyalist. I no longer am, but this version is close enough to the truth, and I know it's what they need to hear. I had to get back here to see you, I conclude, to keep serving the cause. I force myself to stare right into my father's eyes. It takes all of my effort not to flinch from his gaze, just as I know it's taking all of his will not to lunge across the coffee table and strangle me where I stand. In the kitchen, the oven timer dings. My mother, clucking over my heroic and daring escape, excuses herself to check on whatever is in the oven. So? I say to my father, waiting for his reaction. He says nothing, but jumps at me, gathering my shirt in his fist and lifting me off the ground. I hover inches from the floor, held tight by his grip. His face, getting redder every second, glowers before mine.
Tell me why I shouldn't break your neck right this instant.
If you wanted the truth to come out, wanted people to know how I failed you, you wouldn't have bothered to lie to everyone. My twisted collar is beginning to cut off my oxygen. I force myself to keep talking. How'd you convince Ivan to keep your secret? He ignores my question.
If you think having this over me will keep you safe, you are sorely mistaken. If I killed you now, the only person I'd have to tell the truth to is your mother.
He gives me a violent shake.
She'd learn to accept it. She'd have no choice.
My heart seizes. I know he's serious. He could kill me. He wants to kill me. I quickly switch tacks, hoping I'm not too late. I'm sorry, General. Channeling my own mortal terror, I will repentant tears to my eyes. I'm so sorry. He looks at me with renewed contempt. The sight of his son groveling for his life is probably as hard for him as the sight of me turning against the cause. I know my new tactic is as risky as my old one. He could just as easily kill me out of disgust as out of anger. But I keep going. This is the only gambit I have. I failed you, and I failed my people. I'm a coward. I don't have what it takes to kill. On the field of battle, I couldn't stand to see bloodshed. My father releases my shirt, and I drop hard to the floor. I knew coming back was a risk, that I might be justifiably executed for treason, but I thought it was worth it.
Why?
Because, I say, pausing for dramatic effect, scrambling back onto my feet, I hoped you would give me a chance to make up for my failure.
And how do you propose to do that?
I fix my shirt and give him the most unblinking stare I can muster.
Clearly, I don't have what it takes to be a warrior. I'm not like Ivan.
At that, my father lets out a derisive snort.
Son, you are unworthy of even an unflattering comparison to Ivanek.
But I am a better tactician. Ivan never would have gotten through his early studies if I hadn't been there to do his work for him every step of the way. The general's not even looking at me anymore. He's staring towards the kitchen, no doubt preparing himself for the explanation he'll have to give my mother once he's killed me. I can see I'm losing him, yet I press on, trying not to let my desperation show. I found number two first. Back in London, well before your entire team of surveyors managed to pinpoint her location. And in Kenya, I got to number three ahead of Ivan. I didn't have the will to kill them myself, but I found them first. I could be one of the best trackers you have if you just give me a chance. My father lunges at me again, grabbing me by the throat this time. I can't breathe. This is it, I think. This is the end.
1 week, he says. I'll give you 1 week to show me what you can do.
He releases me.
And if you fail to produce a miracle for me in that time...
He trails off. I can tell from his look he expects me to finish his statement. You'll kill me. His level stare confirms that I've guessed right. I nod, accepting his terms. Chapter 6. I lie in my old bed, in my old bedroom, staring at the wall. I was surprised to find everything just as I left it, half expecting it to be stripped bare following my supposed death. I guess my mother won that battle with the general. I try to get comfortable. After months on a bare cot at the aid camp, my expensive pillow-top mattress should feel unbelievably fluffy and soft, but it feels like a bed of nails. After a strained dinner, during which my father and I both pretended to be happy I was home, alone in my room, I can finally let my guard down and drop the fake smile. I'm exhausted and scared. Even if I somehow manage to avoid being executed within the trial week the general has granted me, that's no guarantee I'll manage to break into the labs. And even if I do, that's no guarantee I'll find a successful means of reviving one, of keeping her imminent disappearance at bay. And even if I manage to save her, I have no plan for how to save myself, for how to escape this place once I'm done. I'll need to figure that out, because right now, death doesn't even feel like the worst-case scenario. Passing my father's test and being allowed to remain in this place, having to indefinitely maintain the pretense of being a loyal Mogadorian, feels like the grimmest fate of all. That was hard to watch. One appears, standing in the doorway. I sigh, grateful for her presence. "Didn't realize you were there." She ambles towards me and sits at the foot of the bed. I hung back, tried to stay out of your line of sight, figured you needed to focus. She gives me an affectionate look. Performance of a lifetime, huh? You said it. She looks guilty, worried for my safety. You sure I'm worth it? I manage to fake a confident smile. Definitely. My bedroom door opens and my sister Kelly swings in. Surprised, I hop off the bed. "So you're back," she says bluntly, sizing me up. "Yeah," I say. I'm not sure if I should rush up and embrace her. I decide to wait and follow her lead. "Well, that's good, I guess." She fiddles with the doorknob hesitantly. "You weren't at dinner." Over dinner, my father explained that Ivan had been promoted to a new position somewhere in the Southwest. News that filled me with such relief, I had to cover my mouth so the general wouldn't see how happy I was. But I hadn't been given a reason for Kelly's absence. "Ran late. I'm doing an after-school program at the nursery now." The nursery is what some of us call the piken pens in the underground complex. Pikens are bred in the labs down there and conditioned for combat.
I think I'm going to be a trainer when I graduate. They say I have what it takes.
Oh, I reply. That's great. I can't believe how dumb I sound, how tentative. Back in the hornet's nest of Ashwood, and I'm scared of my own kid sister. It's pathetic.
Whatever, she says. So listen, congratulations on surviving and stuff, and for coming back here. But, you know, having you dead was embarrassing enough. Now I have to explain to my friends that my loser brother is back. You're basically ruining my life.
I'm stunned by her callousness. But I understand. In Mogadorian society, dying in combat is not afforded the prestige it is among most human cultures. And failing in combat and surviving is hardly better than being a traitor. My mother's relief at my survival won't be shared by my sister, or anyone else at Ashwood.
I'm just telling you this so when I ignore you in front of the others, you don't freak out, okay?
Fair enough, I say.
Okay, she says.
She leaves, without a good night, much less that hug. I shoot one a despairing look. She quickly covers her expression of pity with one of her best, most sarcastic grins.
Welcome home, Adamus, she says.
Chapter 7.
A kid a little older than me, named Serkova, comes to get me in the morning. According to the general, he's a promising young surveyor in the Media Surveillance Division. My father assigned him to bring me up to speed and put me to work. We ride the elevator down to the underground complex together. He gives me a sidelong glance.
Heard you bit it in Kenya.
Yeah, I concede, feigning sheepishness.
And now you're angling for a position as a surveyor?
That's the idea, I say. He snorts. Serkova has a generic, true-born face. But there is something gross and oddly piggish about his nose that's even grosser when he snorts.
I didn't know we were in the business of giving failed soldiers second chances.
He turns his stare on me.
Guess there's an exception for the general's son.
The elevator doors open, and we stride into the hub at the center of the underground complex. The domed ceiling and orb-like fluorescent light fixture give it the feel of a massive and massively ugly atrium. Trueborns and Vatborns stride in every direction in and out of the various tunnels, radiating out from the hub. I feel them react to my presence. The Trueborns avoid my gaze, while the Vatborns sneer at me with naked contempt. Word sure traveled fast, even down here. We make our way past the entrances to the southeast and northeast tunnels on our way to the northwest tunnel. With the exception of the general's briefing room, I've never been granted access to any of the tunnels off the hub before. But it's fairly common knowledge that the tunnels lead in one direction to combat training facilities, and in the other direction to weapons stores and bunkers for the Vatborn. We're heading down a third tunnel to the R&D laboratories and the media and surveillance compounds. I struggle to keep pace with Serkova. It's obvious he doesn't like me and resents being saddled with the job of babysitting me.
What's your problem with me?
I genuinely wanted to know. The Mogadorian worldview has become foreign to me so quickly.
So I'm being given a second chance. Why should you care?
Serkova turns to me, a contemptuous sneer on his lips.
You think I don't get enough shit as it is from the combat mogs for being a surveyor? They already call us tech weenies. Now we're being forced to take a proven loser in combat. So the next time they say we're only surveyors because we're not good enough for combat, they'll be right. All thanks to you.
Great. I follow him into the media surveillance facility, a large room lit only by the screens of the 20 or so computer monitors throughout the room. No one looks up as Serkova leads me to my monitor. Thanks to his outburst, I don't have to wonder why. He explains to me what our job is, then sits down at the console next to mine.
Good luck, Adamus,
he says, with evident sarcasm, then gets to work. I turn to my monitor. A steady stream of links scrolls across my screen, in color-coded text.
The Mogadorian mainframe scours satellite and cable TV, radio transmissions, and every last corner of the Internet, 24/7. A certain amount of automated culling occurs before these links reach our screens. Most human interest stories are weeded out in advance, as are most articles or news segments devoted to U.S. or international politics. But a significant majority of what remains, weather reports, natural disaster coverage, police blotters, makes it to our screens as a veritable geyser of hyperlinks. Our job is to sift through the links on our respective screens and sort them, moving material that is clearly of no pertinence to the Mogadorian cause to the discard directory, while kicking material that might have some bearing on our interests up to the investigate directory, where it will be assessed personally by the lead surveyor before being dismissed or moved up the chain to Command HQ. We are also supposed to tag and grade the material we move to the investigate directory according to our judgment of its possible relevance. PV for possible value, HP for high priority, and EHP for extremely high priority. Items we flagged with an EHP rating are simultaneously routed to the lead surveyor and to a small cadre of analysts over at Command HQ for immediate review. Ultimately, if Command HQ is persuaded a news item is a legitimate sign of guard activity, reconnaissance teams are dispatched. All three eliminated guard members were located with some degree of surveyor assistance. But despite our importance, we're really just data monkeys. Exciting stuff like reconnaissance and combat occur outside our purview as surveyors. Not that it's easy work. Within minutes of struggling through this endlessly updating data stream, I miss the clarity and simplicity of my physical labor back in Kenya. Jumping all over the place on the internet, from a story about the birth of quintuplets in Winnetka, Illinois, to a grainy web video from a Syrian insurgent, without getting involved in what I'm reading or seeing is a challenge. And after just 20 minutes of wide-eyed staring at the monitor, my eyes feel like they're going to bleed. Then it gets worse. At the end of the first hour, a little digital bell sounds and a tab pops up on the upper right-hand corner of my screen. My heart sinks. "Oh yeah," says Serkova, managing to smirk at me without looking up from his monitor. "I forgot to mention, we get ranked hourly." Our individual results are tabulated at the end of every hour and broadcast to all the terminals. Number of discards, number of investigates, as well as a provisional computer-graded percentage score for accuracy. There I am, all the way at the bottom, in last place. 27 discards, 6 investigates, and a provisional accuracy ranking of 71%. I scan up the list to see Serkova in second place, with a whopping 82 discards, 13 investigates, and a provisional accuracy ranking of 91%. I'm going to have to go a lot faster. "What was that you were telling your father?" Serkova cracks. I'm too distracted to respond. I need to improve my score, and I resent Serkova's ability to work and needle me at the same time. "Something about what a great tracker you are, how much better you'll be at surveying than we are." Ugh. Not only has the general given me an impossible task, in which failure will result in my death, he's also poisoned the well with my new co-workers by reporting what I said about my superior tracking skills. But I don't bother to respond. I don't have time. I get back to work, fighting against my own dismay. One reason I manipulated the general into placing me in the media and surveillance facility was because I thought I might have enough downtime to use my console to hack into the servers of the adjacent laboratories, do some digging into Dr. Zakos's research. I know that one's only hope lies in those files. But if I don't pull my ranking up soon, my father could justifiably terminate our agreement. I'd be killed before I even got a chance to help one. I need to improve my score. I manage to go faster. The trick, I learn, is not to process any of the information I encounter. Instead, I let my consciousness skim just above the text or video. Then let my judgment occur without thought or reasoning. Basically, the trick is to accept that I am just a cog in a data combing machine. Finally, I feel myself getting into a groove. In the next hourly ranking, I've climbed 2 positions. In the one after that, I'm position 13 out of 20. Luck, Serkova sniffs. I glare at him. I know I'm not here to compete with this jerk, but I can't help it. Wanting to knock him down a peg drives me on. By late afternoon, I've climbed up to position 11. I figure I bought myself enough of a cushion to give myself 5 minutes of snoop time. I quickly page away from the hyperlinks and try to access the hub's central servers. But doing research with a ticking clock hanging over my head proves disastrous. I enter in searches for phrases like mind transfer, Dr. Anu, and Dr. Zakos, but they all lead me to restricted areas on the server, and I don't have time to hack into them. I try to be more general. Remembering what Arsis said about humans in the lab, I do a search for human captives. Instead of directing me to anything about Anu or Zakos' research subjects, I'm led to some internal, hub-wide memo about a broad new policy regarding human captives. Whenever possible, humans suspected of aiding and abetting the guard shall henceforth be held at the government base in Dulce, New Mexico. A government base? Why would the U.S. government have anything to do with the Mogadorians? I put it aside for now. It's an interesting and unsettling tidbit, but it's not going to help me save one. Before I even have a chance to enter a new search, my 5 minutes is up. I turn back to my work. Predictably, that short diversion cost me, and my hourly rank plummets. Regretfully, I accept that I can't afford any more independent research today. We finish at 7 p.m., replaced by the night shift, who will relieve at 7 tomorrow morning. My body aches from remaining hunched and sedentary, and my eyes feel like they've been blasted with sand. I finish the day back in the middle at position 11. Not bad, admits Serkova, getting up from his chair, but hardly what you promised the general. He's right. Landing right in the middle of a group of 20 can hardly qualify me as a master tracker. I can only hope my ranking is enough to let me live another day. I walk the tunnel alone, heading back to the hub. I'm too tired to even consider sneaking off and snooping around the other tunnels. I'd definitely blow my cover.
Arsis, you flaming moron!
Arsis, the idiot assistant technician in the labs. Advancing my secret agenda was the last thing on my mind until I heard that name. Sorry, doctor. I round the corner to see an open doorway leading into one of the laboratories. Inside the gleaming white lab, an incredibly tall and spindly doctor has a young guard backed up against a wall, prodding him with an angry index finger.
These samples were supposed to be refrigerated at sub-zero temperatures. You put them in the regular freezer.
Sorry, sir. The boy is docile, subservient, nothing like the sullen brat I'd imagined from his IM transcripts. The doctor commands him sternly.
Revial the samples from our remaining cultures and get it right this time. You asked to be trusted with more important work. Now show that you can do it properly.
Yes, doctor. Arsis scrambles off to redo his work. I stand gaping at Dr. Zakos at his massive laboratory. This is the man who might be able to save my only friend. He catches me looking. Shit. He glares at me. I either have to turn around and walk away, or think of something fast. Dr. Zakos, I say, deciding to wing it.
Yes?
He looks puzzled. I step forward into the lab. I'm Adamu Sutek, son of General Sutek. He looks at me, evidently suspicious. I wanted to meet you, I go on, because my father has spoken so highly of your work.
my ruse pays off. I watch Dr. Zakos flush with pride. Even Mogadorians have their vanity. An exploitable weakness.
I'm glad the general is satisfied, says the doctor, giving a little involuntary bow.
I was actually a subject in your predecessor's experiments, I continue. The work he did with the first fallen member of the guard. The memory transfer?
Ah, of course, he shakes his head. Dr. Anu's work was a deplorable failure. I'm certain the mind transfer technology I have been developing since is much improved, if I could ever get clearance to actually use it.
I'm confused. Zakos keeps talking, looking at me with much more interest now. I struggle to maintain a neutral expression. You're saying the procedure could be done more successfully now? He nods.
That's my theory.
How is that possible? I thought the procedure needed to be done soon after a subject's death. He cocks his head curiously and ignores my question.
Where have you been since the experiment?
In Africa, I tell him. I don't want to get into too much detail about my activities since I was last with the Mogadorians, but the doctor seems to accept my answer without question.
And did you suffer any side effects due to the procedure you underwent?
I'm tempted to be sarcastic. Only that little coma. But I hold back. Nothing other than those that you already know about. The wheels seem to be turning in his head as he looks me up and down.
It's a possibility, he muses, almost as if to himself. The neural pathways of the guard have been dormant far too long to attempt the transfer again with a new host. But with the original subject from the original experiment...
I can't help interjecting. What are you talking about? What guard? You can't mean her. Dr. Zakos just grins and struts over to the laboratory's wall, which is covered with 10 or so off-white square tiles. He places his hand over a small steel control panel next to the wall and performs an elegant sequence of hand gestures across the panel's surface. With a sudden and jarring hydraulic whoosh, one of the tiles slides out of the wall, opening like a drawer, spewing cryogenic vapors. It's like a mortuary slab. He stares down proudly at what's lying on it.
Have a look, he says.
I step deeper into the lab, peering over the edge of the tile.
Perfectly preserved.
I can't believe my eyes. She doesn't even look dead. She looks like she's sleeping. My best friend in the world. One.